Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions. The audiobook version is broadcast with permission from Blackstone Audio.
It's not PTSD, Grossman said. I told you, it was my heart. Sorry, it's probably my diet, okay, or sitting in the car all day. Well, these tests, Nievold said, leaning in, aren't really indicative of a heart attack, Bob, or really any kind of arrhythmic event. Your levels are all well within the normal range, which is good news, and when we put you on the treadmill, you look quite healthy. He nodded with an upbeat hopefulness that Grossman didn't find at all hopeful. Margie smiled in relief. That's what I told him. Nievold's raised eyebrows wrinkled his forehead as he nodded at Margie. But I'm a cop, Grossman said. PTSD? I deal with it all the time. It's not PTSD. Look, Nievold said, anxiety is... It's not anxiety. Nievold looked at him and nodded. Let's monitor it, okay? We'll keep an eye out for other things it could be, and we'll have you come back in another month, and we'll run the test again. In the meantime, as a precaution, I want you to try taking a baby aspirin a day. Fair enough? Grossman cast a sour but resigned look at Nievold, then sighed and nodded. Fine, whatever. We'll get you back in top form one way or the other, added Nievold. Grossman drove home. Margie finally broke the silence. You know that Panamanian cruise you were always talking about? She asked. Margie, I can't. We gotta find this guy. Otherwise our credibility is shot.
But you don't have to be the one, Bobby.
Look, he exclaimed, more sharply than he'd intended. I can't have this, Margie. I get a mental doc on my record, PTSD, anxiety, whatever they want to call it. I can just kiss my chances of running for sheriff goodbye. She waved dismissively.
Big Bill would still endorse you.
Big Bill Donovan had been elected 7 times, and he was widely considered to be a kingmaker. Big Bill won't be able to do anything. The public doesn't want a cop running around with mental problems, okay? We have guns. You get it? So please, I know you mean well, but just lay off the PTSD, okay? Margie folded her hands in her lap. She looked out the windshield.
I'm worried about you.
Don't be. I'll be fine. She was nonplussed. He glanced over and saw her pensive stare. He hated it when she got like this. He sighed. Look, I'm going to reach out to the Native American community and try to make some inroads on this. If it is panic attacks or whatever you want to call it, then that should make it go away, okay? We've been on bad terms lately, and if I can get some of them working with me so that we solve this thing, it will all go back to normal. Okay? Margie's face lightened, and she nodded, feeling more hopeful.
Okay.
At least it was a constructive approach, something she had been telling him he ought to do for the past 2 or 3 years.
Chapter 31. The night was warm and dark. Ashkagujin Adibigigizis, Mona had called it, a new moon. The eagle feather ceremony was set for this night because it symbolized a new beginning. Mona told J.W. this when he asked if she would come along. Apparently, the event had been publicized in announcements on and off the reservation, even in the Mesabi Daily Mining Advocate, though J.W. hadn't seen any of it. He knew Eagle wouldn't approve of either of them being there, so when he heard her car thundering in, he figured, what the hell, and trudged up and caught her. He half expected her to be drunk, but she was just returning with a few bags of groceries. He needed a guide and companion, he said. He had no idea where the tribal community center was, much less what to expect when he got there. To his surprise, she smiled softly, put a hand on his shoulder, kissed his cheek, and said, I'd be honored. It was dark when he fired up the wild rice truck, and she came down from her house, and he felt almost as if he were going on a date in high school.
"Hi," she said as she got into the truck. She had on a beaded leather jacket, and she wore boots over her skinny jeans. Her diamond stud earrings glittered in the dashboard lights. She gave him a smile and swiped her hair off her cheek.
"You ready for this?"
She raised an eyebrow. She was wearing dark eyeliner, and her smile was skeptical, as if she thought he was in for something that he might not be able to handle.
"Yeah," he said, shifting into reverse.
"New experience."
"You've been getting a lot of them lately."
She turned the Clapton on and cranked up the volume.
"Let's rock it white man style," she said, holding up two fists and snapping her fingers.
"You think that's white man style?"
"Oh, love,"
she sang along with Clapton, but even more sentimentally.
"Shut up,"
he said, and turned it off.
"You're spoiling it."
She laughed and clapped her hands in delight. He knew how to be teased. She was ready for a fun evening. J.W. followed Mona's instructions and head up over the hill past her house, a direction he'd taken only once before. 10 miles down the dark, winding road, the community center sat on a hill overlooking Waterfowl Lake. He parked the truck in a close-cropped field just east of the center. As they stepped out of the truck, J.W. looked up to see stars so thick and a sky so black that his balance left him, and he grabbed the truck bed for support. The whole field seemed to lose its earth and sail like a ship through the heavens. He felt sewn into things, a part of the firmament. He passed the tailgate, came together with Mona, and felt her warm, dry hand slip into his.
"It's pretty awesome, huh?" she said.
"Yeah." They flowed together through the ether. Stars had always had the power to do that to him, but tonight, out here with Mona, the effect was somehow enhanced. A warm breeze lifted his hair and washed his cheeks. Beat-up old Toyotas and Buicks rumbled and bumped into the hayfield, their headlights casting yellow beams that bobbed around them as if they were at a drive-in movie. The building looked like a giant spaceship from a science fiction double feature, or a sculpture of some sort in Minneapolis. Ground-set floodlights lit a long architectural wing of stacked flagstone and glass that shot northward like an arrow toward Waterfowl Lake. On the south end was a large round structure in the shape of a gigantic drum. Jutting out from it was a corner of stone and glass that reached toward a wetland and the distant tribal fire station 100 yards beyond. J.W. recognized the fire truck and tanker from a week ago, glowing in the yellow light that emanated from open garage doors. The entry reached out toward them with a long, thick wood portico and a walkway of enormous stone tiles. As they walked in through the new glass doors to a sweeping atrium, J.W. could hear drums. The room had high, clear-story windows that glistened with stars. Hidden lights wrapped gently over the red-hued wooden posts and beams and the blue and maroon and ochre of the artwork. Stacked gray flagstones made up some of the walls, and he felt as though he were a frog on the bottom of a great pond. They turned down a smaller hallway that was lined with wide walls of wood panels, hung with the tanned pelts of moose and deer and wolf. Old black-and-white photos of Indians were interspersed among the pelts, and display cases contained beaded leather jackets and feathered memorabilia. A well-lit wall farther down was completely covered with hundreds of framed 8x10 photos of tribal members who had served in the various branches of the United States Armed Forces since World War II. J.W. looked at the names, but there was no apparent order.
"People are encouraged to move them around," Mona said. "They put them by other relatives. The whole wall slowly organizes itself according to our living clans. That way we can see how we are all connected. And we don't forget the ones who died or are missing."
J.W. nodded, and she led him on. The drums were louder here, and people were passing them from behind. They turned a corner, and she pulled him toward double doors opening into a loud and crowded gymnasium. The bleachers were full and buzzing. The yellow-painted concrete block wall was emblazoned with a single word in blue letters: Perseverance. Near the center of the room, four men beat a traditional moose-hide drum that was about 3 feet in diameter. They wore ribbon shirts, which looked like Western-style golf shirts with ribbons hanging from the shoulder yokes and buttons that only went down part way. The drum head was held taut with leather thongs. Four leather pouches, equally spaced around the drum, held four staffs that faced the four directions, each dangling an eagle feather. J.W. and Mona made their way across the gym floor to an open spot on the far bleachers. As they picked their way up through the crowd, there were points and giggles.
"Zugasi," J.W. heard someone say.
Mona blushed and squeezed his hand, pulling him onward.
"What are they saying?"
"They think you're my boyfriend," she replied.
As they sat, other men stepped up to the drummers and began to sing a grand entry song. Some of them wore ribbon shirts and jeans, others wore street clothes. One wore a suit, and others wore traditional garb in the old style, one with horn-rimmed glasses. A few of them began to dance clockwise around the drum. The men's mixed clothing reminded J.W. of their yards. He could discern no rules of order. Mona leaned in and lifted a finger toward them as she talked, warm and humid by his cheek.
"Those are some elders and tribal council members and other leaders."
He nodded. The music suddenly stopped, and the dancers filed off and sat down. The room quieted. It was hot, and smelled of bodies and sweetgrass. J.W. looked around for Eagle and Jacob, but couldn't see them.
"Where are they?"
"Somewhere in the crowd."
An elder stood and made his way toward the drum, holding an eagle feather that trailed a red horsehair tie. He waved it to the east.
"Wabanung!"
He turned to the south.
"Zowanung!"
He turned west and waved it there.
"Ningabianung!"
Finally, he waved it in the general direction of J.W. and Mona.
"Giwedanung!"
Mona leaned in close and put a hand on J.W.'s forearm.
"Wow, they're really going all out. This is like a powwow."
"Mugase!"
the elder called out to the crowd, and after a moment a man stood. It was Johnny Eagle. There was smoke in the air, a fine scrim of it. He was wearing a ribbon shirt with jeans and fancy cowboy boots. The elder began to speak in Ojibwe.
"It is not every day," he said, "that we honor one of our sons or daughters with a bald eagle feather."
Mona leaned in close and translated. Her breath smelled of spruce gum. He could feel the warmth of her forearm against his and the curve of her breast where it pressed against his biceps.
"It is illegal for anyone in the United States to possess these feathers except in this rare honor,"
the elder said in English for the benefit of the children and the few non-native visitors he saw in the audience. His high, reedy voice carried clearly across the gymnasium.
"Our brother Johnny Eagle is being given this highest honor for his selfless efforts on behalf of the band," the elder continued, "from his wild rice business, which has offered a livelihood to many, to the new bank, whereby we may support ourselves and take care of our own people with our own businesses. This is a good vision, and it is a vision not just for those of us in this room, but for our children and our children's children, on down through seven or more generations."
Eagle looked awkward and uncomfortable in the ribbon shirt, yet regal in presence and bearing, as if he were somehow above these strange Ojibwe ways, but was humoring them and humbling himself nonetheless. He towered over the people seated around him in the audience. The elder moved next to the drum and then motioned Eagle in with a wave. The drummers began beating the drum, and a singer stepped up next to them to sing a traditional eagle feather honor song. Eagle stepped off the last bleacher and down onto the gym floor. He seemed to hesitate for a moment, and then he stepped into a dance, moving slowly over the painted court stripes toward the center of the gym floor, dancing clockwise, or sunwise, around the drum, tall and awkward in his cowboy boots. When he passed the elder handed the eagle feather to him. Eagle took it and kept dancing clockwise around the drum, and then the whole drum group joined the singing. taking the whole thing very seriously, despite Eagle's lack of grace. Eagle made another clockwise circle, dancing around the singing drummers and holding the eagle feather aloft to the four directions. Then Jacob stood up in the bleachers. J.W. saw that he, too, was wearing a ribbon shirt, and he looked even more awkward and stiff than his father. J.W. shifted in his seat, suppressing an urge to wave to him. Jacob looked at the bleacher steps and began taking them one by one down onto the floor. He glanced toward J.W. without making eye contact, then started dancing.
"God, I feel bad for him," J.W. said.
Mona squeezed his arm.
"Don't."
Jacob danced his way in and followed his father around the singing dancers. As he did, people began to stand. By the time he had made a circuit, the whole crowd was up and moving with the rhythm of the drums, dancing down onto the gym floor.
"Come on," Mona said, pulling at his hand.
The people already on the floor began following Jacob and Johnny in a huge clockwise wake around the drum, dancing to the beat. People were flowing around J.W. and Mona from upper levels of the bleachers and hopping down onto the floor. She pulled harder.
"Come on," she said.
He followed her down onto the floor. He did a little one-legged hop, trying to dance, but now it was his turn to feel horribly awkward and self-conscious. People laughed, and some pointed, enjoying his white gawkiness. Mona leaned in and yelled to him,
"If Jacob can do it alone, you can do it in a crowd."
She turned away and danced on, keeping hold of his hand. It felt more awkward for J.W. to walk, so eventually he tried first one step, then another, and pretty soon he was dancing, trying to keep up with her, and then he was just a part of the dance, and the whole room was heaving and circling in a shaggy mass. The music ended with four powerful drum beats, and the room fell mostly quiet. People were sweating and smiling. J.W. found himself grinning at strangers. Johnny Eagle mounted a short dais so he could be seen. He held the eagle feather aloft, and the crowd began to applaud.
"Good evening, Anishinaabeg," he said in a booming voice,
and the crowd went wild.
"Thank you so very much. Thank you."
His powerful voice echoed over the sustained roar.
"Thank you. Thank you."
Still, the applause continued.
"Thank you."
He held up a hand again, and the room finally grew quiet. He laughed.
"You guys are great," he said,
and they applauded again. He stood, taking it in, and J.W. had the sense that he was watching some sort of transformation. When the crowd finally began to settle, Eagle began in a speaking tone, and they quieted to hear him.
"What is a bank?"
He looked around at them with confidence.
"To its shareholders, it's a way to make money off your money. To its depositors, it's a safe place to store their money. But to its borrowers, to them it's a precious resource, allowing them to attain the American dream of home ownership and a college education, or even a basic car with four wheels that are all the same size and color."
The audience laughed, and he took in their response for a moment before becoming serious again. He used his hand, his fist, and he pointed for emphasis, but always with passion and a smile, as if he had been speaking for years.
"That resource is called opportunity. Opportunity. A bank is where we can come together as a community in order to pool our resources, to help one another prosper in good times and get by in bad. But too often we see credit denied, not on the basis of risk, but by greedy profiteering, masked as concerns over tribal sovereignty. This happens to our brothers and sisters all across this great country, denying them the opportunities others in our shared nation take for granted. Now, we cannot blame our white brethren."
Here there were scattered boos from a few young men, but Eagle held a hand up to quiet them, shaking his head.
"No, we can't. No, we can't. It is too easy to chalk this all up to race, especially in times like these when tensions run high. Both whites and Indians do it. We are both trapped by the sins of our fathers, all those poisoned waters.
all those hard feelings and justifiable suspicions that make the present and the future so hard to see. But if we are truthful, we must admit that we all have a share of the responsibility. We cannot expect a white banker in Northlake, Minnesota, to lend to a homeowner on a reservation if he cannot secure the loan. And we cannot blame a white banker in Detroit Lakes for worrying about stable property values in native areas where addiction and crime run at higher than normal rates. These are just the economic realities. And even if we could blame them, where would it get us? But neither can we accept the lack of capital that helps create that poverty in the first place. If we can't borrow from the white man, then we must open our own banks with our own money and create our own opportunities.
The crowd thundered with applause. Mona leaned over.
We don't normally clap like this, she yelled.
Now, Eagle continued, we all know what happened down at the construction site. Maybe it was an accident, and maybe it wasn't. But what I can tell you for sure is that it's not going to slow us down.
The crowd applauded again, and some of the young men whooped.
Let me be clear. I do not condone the kind of cowardly act that resulted in someone trying to set fire to the North Lake Bank, nor shooting at a good police officer. That may not have been one of us, we don't know. But the deputy says he saw Indians running away from the scene of the crime. I like to think we are better than that, and I hope those involved are brought swiftly to justice.
More applause, led mostly by women, with a few men joining in. J.W. noticed Jacob was looking at the floor.
Today I met with the tribal council, and they voted to dedicate part of this gorgeous new community center to house our new bank. It's not as close to North Lake, but it's still on the main road, and it has one great advantage I hadn't considered. It's next door to the tribal fire department.
The crowd laughed and applauded again.
So, what is a bank? A bank is community. A bank is all of us pulling together and becoming more than the sum of our parts. A bank is hope and a vision for a brighter, more prosperous tomorrow. Thank you for this great honor. It means more to me than you can imagine. Thank you, Anishinaabeg.
Eagle waved and stepped back as the crowd gave him a huge ovation. J.W. glanced at Mona as they applauded. He was stunned by the sense of greatness in Eagle's transformation, the effortlessness of it, and the sense of unity and vision he had created in the audience. He felt the hair standing on his neck. The gym was getting hot and stuffy. People were gathering around Eagle in a big crush, seeking to congratulate him.
Do you want to stay?
Mona shouted over the din. J.W. shook his head.
I don't want to spoil his night.
She laughed.
You wouldn't. There's a rule that everyone has to leave animosity outside when they enter a powwow.
But J.W. shook his head. Rule or no rule, he was too intimately connected with everything Eagle had spoken about. And then there was the fact that he still had to find a way to stop him, or he would lose everything. Congratulating him now would only make it harder.
We can talk to him later, he said.
As they walked back through the great entry hall, the colors of the artwork seemed even more vivid, the piled flagstone walls even more palpable, and the soaring wood columns even richer. J.W. wanted to run his hands over everything. He wondered at his heightened senses. Some white people he had known sought this sort of thing out. They clothed themselves in native traditions like spiritual outfits, traveling to powwows and sweat lodges and pipe ceremonies as if they were horse shows, with more dedication than many Indians. J.W. had always thought of this as a sort of cultural gentrification, and he found it annoying. People should just be who they were, and he knew that most Indians didn't like such skinwalkers either. But there was something about the sense of connectedness he felt after dancing with everyone, and nobody really caring or judging him, that was undeniable. He felt light, which was making everything more difficult. They pushed out through the glass doors into the warm, dark night, and Mona slipped her small hand into his. The sky pulsed down at them, fat stars throbbing with the beat of the drums echoing in his mind. Mona gave his hand a little squeeze at the tailgate, and they parted and walked up either side of the truck to their respective doors. Chapter 32. J.W. drove back along the dirt road to Mona's house. She slid over next to him on the fur and stubbed out her cigarette, leaving only the peach and tobacco smell of her hair behind.
"Thank you," she said.
"For what?"
"I don't know. Just bringing me. Being a good sport with our Indian ways."
"I should be thanking you. Imagine me trying to dance alone." She laughed.
"It was good to see him honored," she said.
Her face and dark hair were lit softly by the dashboard.
"People haven't been too accepting of him until now," she said.
"Well, it looks like he's overcome that." She nodded.
"Johnny is a force of nature. He always has been."
She tilted her head onto his shoulder and put a hand on his knee. Her hair licked at his face, then fell away in the buffeting breeze from the window. He suddenly realized how long it had been since he'd had anybody put a head on his shoulder or a hand on his knee, and the sense drew a well of emotion up inside him. He turned his face into her hair for a brief moment, letting the smell and the feel of her feed him. After a moment, Mona spoke again.
"I've been thinking about what you said, about feeling bad instead of trying to make the feeling go away. I haven't had a drink since we talked. I want you to know that's major progress for me."
"I know it is," he replied, a little taken aback. "Congratulations."
"I feel like I've known you for a long time."
He squeezed her hand and they drove on in silence, the road leaping forward into the headlights, then falling away, frogs and crickets singing in their wake. He remembered a night camping with Julie, when they had hiked to a precipice in the boundary waters and lain there looking up.
"What if the world is upside down," she had asked, "and we could fall off into the sky?"
As he and Mona topped the ridge and came down from the heavens, he saw a car turn on its lights as it emerged from the trailer park lane. It turned and headed away down the road toward the highway. It was a dark night for someone to have driven down that hill and forgotten to turn on their lights, he thought. And then he suddenly realized that it must have been someone coming out of his parking area. As the car neared the curve, his headlights picked up a small hint of red on its back bumper. A vague sense of recognition shot through him, and then the other car turned the corner and drove out of sight. That spot of color was in the same place as the NRA bumper sticker on the back of Sam Schmeeker's car. And the car was dark and sporty, with a slightly elevated back end, just like Sam's.
You have been listening to Episode 19 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for episode 20 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.